continuing where we were last time. Is this loud enough? Can you hear me in the back? Turn it up some more? A little bit? Okay. I just want to be sure there isn't too much feedback. So we'll turn it up a little bit more. I want to start today by wrapping up RNA synthesis that we were talking about last time. There were a few fine points we didn't get to. So I want to redraw the picture on the bottom of 12B, which looks, and there's also a similar picture in your notes that shows a DNA with two bubbles, so we're making RNA. We've opened it up in two spots so we can make RNA. Well, I slowed it down anyway. This board isn't weighted properly. So here's our RNA. Here's our DNA with top strand 5 prime to 3 prime left to right, bottom strand anti-parallel. So in our picture, on the left bubble, we've used the top strand as template, meaning that our new RNA had to be made anti-parallel to the template from its 5' end to its 3' end, so it has to be made right to left. And on the second bubble on the right, we've used the bottom strand as template. And in that case, we had to make RNA going in the opposite direction from its 5' to 3', so it would be anti-parallel to the template. Now, we explained last time that in each region of the DNA, only one strand is used as template. Now, we have to consider what the rationale for that is and how it works. So let's just consider how it works first. In order for this to happen, there has to be a signal to start DNA replication. And also have to be signals to start RNA transcription. Now, when you copy a DNA molecule in replication, you copy the entire thing. So you really only need one origin. There are often more, but you only need one. You have to start somewhere, and then either uni or bidirectionally copy the entire DNA. And so the symbol for starting DNA synthesis is called an origin, often abbreviated ORI or ORI. But for RNA synthesis, for transcription, it's different. Since we make short RNAs, we have to have a signal that says sort of start here, stop there. And these are labeled on your handout, actually, as P and T. Because the place where you start RNA transcription is usually called the promoter. It's a little to the left, actually, of where the actual start is. And the sequence or area where you stop making RNA is usually called a terminator. This has an ominous sound, but it just means you stop. So what are these things? How does a cell know that a promoter is a promoter? Or an origin is an origin. Now, of course, cells don't know anything. They don't have any brains. So the issue here is, what is it that causes DNA polymerase to start at an origin and RNA polymerase to start as a promoter? These signals, so we should put in here that the start for RNA is called a promoter. And this is in your table on the handout from last time for reference. That there's a specific sequence at a promoter, specific DNA sequence. There's a specific sequence at an origin, and a specific sequence at a terminator. Now, for these two different kinds of starts, the start signal for replication is recognized by DNA polymerase. The start signal or the promoter for RNA synthesis is recognized by the RNA polymerase. So these DNA sequences are actually binding sites for the corresponding enzyme. The 3D shape of the enzyme matches the double-stranded DNA sequence of the corresponding part. So a promoter is a binding site for RNA polymerase. While an origin is a binding site for DNA polymerase. Now, these sequences are double-stranded. Both the enzyme, the respective enzymes, and the sequences are asymmetric. Therefore, DNA or RNA polymerase binds to the DNA and is oriented facing in a given direction. Now, that seems more important and clearer in the case of promoters. In the case of our two RNA syntheses shown up here, for the left bubble, RNA synthesis has to start to the right of the bubble at the promoter, and RNA synthesis has to go left. But in the case of the right bubble, RNA synthesis has to start at the left of the bubble and go to the right. And the reason that works is that DNA polymerase binds to the promoter facing in the appropriate direction. I think of a promoter sort of like a chair. This stool won't work. Suppose we had a real chair with a back, and the chair was facing that door at the end of the stage. So the chair is like the promoter, and I'm the DNA the RNA polymerase. Once I sit down in that chair, I am facing that away. And so the only way transcription is going to go is in that direction. If the chair were turned around, then the promoter, so to speak, faces the opposite direction. RNA polymerase sits down the other way, and transcription goes in the other direction. So the structure of the promoter determines the direction of transcription. But once I've decided which way transcription goes, that determines which of the two strands is going to be template. Because if you look at the second bubble, if transcription is going to go left to right, the new RNA has to be made anti-parallel to the template. So I have to use the bottom strand as template, in which case the top is the sense strand. And the reverse is true for the other bubble. Now, in addition to having a signal that says start transcription here, that's the promoter, we have a sequence in the DNA that says stop transcription here. We're not going to go into the details of exactly how that works. There's more than one way. But this particular sequence leads to the ending of transcription. Now, the way it works in eukaryotes is a little different, and we'll talk about that next semester. But the basic idea here is it's not just enough to get started, you also have to finish at some predetermined spot to get a short RNA.
So it binds to the double strand section, the enzyme?
The enzyme, the DNA or the RNA polymerase, binds to a double-stranded section, not to one strand. Now, we often write the promoter on one side, because we're interested in which strand gets transcribed. But the actual promoter sequence that's binding is double-stranded. Are there any other questions about any of this? Okay. So now let's come back to the rationale here. Why is it that only one of the two strands is template or only one of the two is sense, depending on which way you look at it? There are two rationales for this. One of them is an evolutionary functional argument. If you optimize by selection one strand, let's say the sense strand, to code for a reasonable protein which carries out a function, then the complementary strand is not going to code for anything very useful. You can't optimize the sequences on both strands so as to get two useful proteins. It's very difficult to do and almost never happens. There are some exceptions. And so what's happened is only one half, essentially, one strand has been optimized to code for an optimal protein, and the other strand is only there for transcription and to help replication. The other argument is a little different. Suppose we did transcribe both sides of the DNA. Suppose we made some transcript from the top strand and some from the bottom strand. And then those two RNAs floated off. Well, what would those RNAs do? Are they related to each other?
Yes.
They're actually complementary. And they will probably bind each other, and then neither will be able to do anything. They will gum each other up. So this argument is that if you have so-called the regular RNA is usually called synth. So here's our regular RNA, messenger RNA. It's going to be used to line up amino acids and make protein. That's called synth. If you have its complement around, the complement is called antisense. Now, it turns out that there's actually a function for antisense RNA. There's a lab function for it, and there's a real in vivo biological function for it in some cases. When we think of genetic disease, we think of a situation where there's something wrong with the gene, therefore there's something wrong with the protein, therefore the protein doesn't work. That's the usual situation. Now, we understand, at least in theory, how to fix that. If you provided a good copy of the gene, you would make a good copy of the protein, and you would be okay. Now, we can't at the moment do this, but we, at least not most of the time. But we have an idea of how we should and how this would work. But it turns out that in at least some diseases, the problem is exactly the reverse. The gene needs to be turned off to cure the disease. We don't need to replace it with a good copy. We need to shut it down. Because the gene is making either the wrong protein or too much protein, and that is causing the problem. Many cancers are thought to be caused by an overactive gene causing too much cell growth. So the question is, how could you shut down a gene so that the cell stops making this extra protein? So people thought of antisense. The cell is making message. DNA is making RNA. And RNA, the message, is being used to make protein. Now, what if we added antisense RNA? The antisense RNA is the complement of the RNA. It will hybridize with the sense RNA, and now you won't be able to translate it. You won't be able to use the information. You won't make the protein. You'll shut off the RNA, no protein. Now, people have done this. But the problem largely, there are a lot of problems with this. One is getting the RNA into the right cell. The other problem is RNA is relatively easily degraded, and so that makes it harder. Even if you can target it correctly, it tends to get degraded on the way there or once it gets in the cell. So people have used substituted RNAs that are a little bit different and more resistant to degradation. And this has worked in a few cases, but it all in all hasn't been all that effective. Adding the RNA from the outside doesn't work too well. So people had another idea. Let's get the cell to make its own antisense RNA. Now, the general trick to that is to use genetic engineering to add a second copy of the gene. So you have two copies of the gene. The original copy, say, has its promoter right here. The second one also has its promoter on the left, the way I've drawn it. Now, the trick to this is that copy number two is upside down. Copy number two is not the same as copy number one. It's inserted backwards. Meaning that if I label these strands Watson and Crick, in copy number two, they are reversed. Now, the easiest way to see this is probably with a model. So I brought a little piece of short DNA here, and I've labeled the five prime ends for you. Because remember, two strands are anti-parallel. if the promoter is over here on my right and transcription goes to my left, which strand will be template? How do we make the new one, the new RNA? Which end do we start from? It's 5 prime, add to its 3. So the template has to be the opposite. So if I'm going this way, I have to use the bottom as the template. But what if I had a copy of the gene that was turned around? Now notice, if I go in the same direction, I'll copy whatever's on the bottom. But now, Crick used to be on the bottom, Watson is on the bottom. So I won't get the same MR, I'll use the opposite strand as template. Another way of thinking about it is, what if I left the gene alone and I moved the promoter from one end to the other end? Same result. If the promoter goes from the right, I'll use the bottom strand. If the promoter goes from the left, I'll use the top strand. So either you move the promoter around or you turn the gene around. Now, one of the advantages of labeling it like this is you can see if I cut this gene out, turned it around and tried to put it back, all the 5 and the 3 prime ends would match. I would still have a 5 here and a 5 here. Because remember, DNA doesn't have a head and a tail. Each end has a 5 and a 3. So if I cut out a piece and turn it around, I still can match up the 5 prime and the 3 prime ends properly. So by genetic engineering, you either cut the gene out, turn it over and put it back, the second copy, or you move the promoter. So as a result, you make, say, the complement to Crick from one copy, the complement to Watson from the other, the 2 hybridize and no protein. Now, that has been done in some limited cases. And it has been moderately successful. But people realized, as a result of doing this experiment, that you don't have to go to these lengths. There's actually a much easier way to turn off translation. And that's by adding double-stranded RNA, corresponding to the section we want to shut down. If we add double-stranded RNA corresponding to this message, it turns out that cells have enzymes to cut the double-stranded RNA up into short pieces if it isn't short already. You get relatively short double-stranded RNA, and then the sense strand is degraded. And all you have is a short piece of antisense. Well, what will it do? If I have antisense and I have message, what's going to happen? My antisense is going to stick to my message. And it turns out you don't have to cover up the whole message. All you need is a little piece. And if you cover up a short section, it takes about 20 base pairs. If you have a short RNA around 20 long, it combines with the mRNA, and now one of two things happens. So the short antisense meets the message, and one of two things happens depending on the fine points. Either there's just no translation, so you block translation, or in some cases the sense strand is degraded. In which case, the antisense is left and can go zap another mRNA. Now, this phenomenon is known as interference, RNA interference, or RNAi. And it was discovered more or less by accident, but it's turned out to be enormously useful. Because double-stranded RNA is much more stable than single-stranded RNA, and it's much easier to make short double-stranded RNA and add that. And that inside the cell is turned into antisense, which shuts off the messenger RNA. And the Nobel Prize in, I think it was chemistry, but it might have been biology and medicine, it's in your notes, the Nobel Prize for 2006 was given to the people who discovered RNAi. Thank you. So what is RNAi good for? The idea is therapeutically, you can use it the same way you would use antisense. By adding double-stranded RNA, and you could use very short double strand, which is easy to make in a test tube, you could shut a gene off. And people are in the process of trying to do that. It's been successful in one or two cases. They're trying it in others. So it has a therapeutic use. Now, it's been used a lot in laboratories to shut off one gene at a time and see what happens. Because how do you figure out what a gene does? The only way to figure it out is to break it. You have to shut it off or mutate it and see what happens. So this has been used, as they say, to knock down production of individual proteins from individual genes and to see what happens. You add a lot of a double-stranded RNA, you cut down translation, what happens to function? Now, it turns out that RNAi, or something very similar to it, is a normal cell function. Why would cells have the enzymes to deal with double-stranded RNA? Do cells normally make double-stranded RNA? Not that you've heard of, and they don't, as far as we know. But it turns out that many viruses, as part of their replication, require the synthesis of double-stranded RNA. So it's possible that the reason that cells are able to chew up and use double-stranded RNA is it's a defense against viruses. That when the viral double-stranded RNA is there, the cells chew it up to short pieces and use it to inhibit translation of viral messenger RNA. So it may be a defense against viruses. Now, the final discovery is that cells do something like this naturally to regulate production of their own proteins in some cases. It's known that some cells make their own short antisense RNA. And then they use that to turn off production of proteins they don't need anymore. And this appears to be a very important regulatory mechanism in development. What we mean by development is how you have one cell that starts a person or an organism. The egg and sperm from the parent come together, you get a single cell. That cell divides many times. But those cells, even though they have the same DNA, don't all act the same. Your brain cells do not act the same as your foot cells. Different cell types turn on and off different genes and production of different proteins. And it's a very complicated choreographed process. And it's possible, it's thought, that this small RNA, antisense RNA, is important in switching from one state to the next. Now, the small antisense RNAs that are made by cells on purpose to turn off protein synthesis when they don't need that protein anymore, those are usually called microRNAs. And they also are extremely short. Now, we're not going to say any more about how this works, but there are references in your notes to the fine points and in your textbooks, especially in Becker, to the fine points of how you handle microRNA versus how you handle double-stranded RNA. But the point we're getting at here is that if you have an antisense RNA, it will bind to the message and interfere with translation of the message. And people have taken advantage of that, and apparently cells have too. Yes?
The double strand, why does the sense strand degrade, but the antisense?
Why does the sense strand degrade and the antisense doesn't? Well, that's because the cells have an enzyme that does that. But the answer is that that provides function. If you did the reverse, you'd get nowhere. So you can see why there has been selection for an enzyme that degrades the sense, leaving the antisense to do its thing. If you degrade, if the enzyme degraded the antisense, there would be no result. Yes.
So is double-stranded RNA easier to introduce into the cell because it doesn't degrade as much?
Why is it easier to introduce double-stranded RNA? First of all, it doesn't degrade as much, but second of all, the realization now is you only need a short double-stranded RNA. When people originally thought about antisense, they thought you would have to introduce a long antisense about as long as the message. Now we realize that you can do a very short one. So a short double-stranded RNA is both easier to manipulate and it is less, it is more resistant to degradation than single-stranded. There is still the problem of getting it into the right cells, which isn't totally solved. Now, we have covered most of the features of DNA versus RNA synthesis that I wanted to. The one thing we didn't talk about is proofreading. We mentioned it very briefly last time, and there's a long section in this time's notes about the fine points, because in some years we've gone into it in great detail. But all I want to talk about today is a very brief summary of the point. We mentioned last time that DNA polymerase is capable of backing off and knocking off nucleotides from the 3' end. It has 3', 5' exonuclease activity. And somebody asked, why bother? The idea is, here's the template strand. Now we're making DNA. Here is the new strand that's growing. And suppose there was a T in the template. So we should put an A in here, right? Well, suppose you make a mistake, you put G in instead. If this were RNA polymerase, we would have to keep going. There would be no alternative. But if this is DNA polymerase, let's say the base here, I'll just write an X. DNA polymerase is capable of backing up and breaking this bond between the G and the previous. And that allows you to go back to the previous case. Now, the enzyme can try again. We can put a new nucleotide in here, and hopefully this time it'll be A. So this is a correction mechanism. It used to be called editing. It's now usually called proofreading, because editing is used for something else. But the basic idea is to catch the typos. That RNA polymerase doesn't have to catch typos, or we manage well enough if it doesn't, because RNAs are continually made, used, degraded, and thrown away. Even the ones that last a long time can eventually be replaced. But DNA is your archival copy, and you want to be sure that the copies are accurate. And so proofreading keeps down the error rate in DNA replication. Now, you don't want DNA replication to be perfect. You have to have an occasional mistake so that you can get variation and you can get selection and evolution. But you don't want very many mistakes. You want most of the DNA to be copied correctly. Now, RNA polymerases, as a rule, do not do this. They don't back up. And DNA polymerases do. This is related to the phenomenon that RNA polymerases can start new chains and DNA polymerases can only add. The reason for this comes out of this picture. DNA polymerase has to be able to back up. If it has to be able to back up, it means there has to be a bond between whatever is on the end and the guy before, the nucleotide before. When you first start a chain, there is no nucleotide on the other side. There is no bond. And so DNA polymerase won't start. RNA polymerase doesn't care who's on the left side of this G. DNA polymerase does. And that's due to a difference in the structure of the two enzymes. Now, this is explained in greater detail in your notes, but as it says very clearly, we're not going to ask you about any of this. It's largely there to satisfy your curiosity. This is the level at which we're going to talk about. So DNA polymerase is able to back off RNA, back up and knock off mistakes. RNA polymerase is not. Now, this is really all I wanted to say about the compare and contrast between DNA and RNA synthesis. So let me stop here and ask if there are questions before we go on from transcription to translation. Because what I want to consider now is, suppose you do transcription and you make all the RNAs that you need. How do you use those RNAs to actually make a protein? How does translation work? So if we were to redo our DNA makes RNA picture here properly, we know that you open up a section of the DNA. You use one strand as template, and you get some RNA. And we've said many times that this RNA is decoded or read to line up appropriate amino acids. So now the question is how? So the first thing we want to realize is we said already that RNA is read in triplets. That a group of three nucleotides, specifically three bases, specifies one amino acid. But, of course, there's the question, which end do we start from? Which direction do we read? Now, it happens to be as in English. We always write our RNA 5' to 3', and it's actually made that way, but it's also read that way. So we read from left to right in the standard convention. Now, we read in triplets. Let's put some actual ones in here. Let's see. I just made this up. I made a sequence. So we actually read, starting from a fixed point, in a non-overlapping manner, three at a time. Now, which three are we going to pick? You realize that we could start here the way I've written it, and read GCA, UGC, etc. Or we can start with C and go CAU, GCA, etc. Or we can start with AUG, CA blah, etc. But notice if I move one more over, I'm back to the same triplets. I've started with the second one, but it's the same idea. So there are three possible what are called reading frames. And you have to pick one. Translation doesn't normally start at the very 5' end, and it doesn't end at the very 3' end. It starts somewhere in. There's a part first that you don't translate. And then you normally start at the first AUG. This codon, AUG, doubles. It means both start and the amino acid methionine. So starting from AUG, that would be the first amino acid. And let's say this one is CAU, is the next triplet. This triplet is called a codon. And we read one triplet or codon at a time. What amino acid corresponds to CAU? This is easy. You have a piece of paper that tells you. On your handout, 13A is the code table. And so you have to look. I don't remember what it is. Let's see. You don't have to memorize this code table. You just have to find it. What did you say, histidine? Yeah, I think that's right. Yes, histidine. So that means the first amino acid would be methionine, and it would be linked to histidine, and so on. Now, you keep going until you hit one of the codons that's listed here is stomp. The start codon is simultaneously start and an amino acid. The stop codons mean only stop. So if you were to hit, say, UGA here, which is one of your stop codons, it would mean the last amino acid in your peptide would be whatever the triplet or codon here is. You would stop, when you got to UGA, you'd say, okay, we're done. And we'll explain how you know that in a bit. Now, we just said that you don't normally start at the absolute 5' end. There's a section here which can be quite long, which is not translated. It's involved in the process of getting it started, etc., but it's not itself translated. And this is called either a leader or a 5' untranslated sequence. Or a 5' untranslated region. Similarly, when you get a stop codon, there's usually a section before you get to the 3' end that's not involved directly in translation. And that section here, after the stop codon, is called a 3' untranslated sequence, or a 3' untranslated region, or a trail. In prokaryotes, leaders and trailers are usually fairly short, but in eukaryotes, they can be quite long. Okay. So I know AUG is methionine because I remembered it. We figured out that CAU was histidine because you had the code table and you looked it up. How does your cell know that CAU is histidine? Your cell does not have a copy of the code table. How does it know? It was actually Crick, I think, who realized that there has to be an adapter in the cell. There has to be some molecule in the cell that has one end that sticks to CAU and the other end that sticks to histidine. And that molecule is transfer RNA. And what we want to consider next is, what is transfer RNA and how does it fit in? So it's said to serve an adapter function. And the molecule is symbolized in multiple different ways. We often write it this way, to symbolize that one end holds an amino acid and the other end has a triplet that is complementary to the codon. This is the complement of the codon. Therefore, it's called an anticodon. Now, in order for protein synthesis to work right, you have to have two good matches. The anticodon has to properly match up with the codon. Then, the right amino acid has to be on the tRNA. So two matches have to be made. The amino acid has to be matched to the tRNA, and then the tRNA bottom, anticodon, has to match the codon. Now, the codon-anticodon part works by hydrogen bonding stabilized by a structure called a ribosome, to which we will return. What matches up the amino acid and its appropriate tRNA? Remember, there are 20 different amino acids, so there are at least 20 different transfer RNAs. Who makes the match here? Who catalyzes everything? Enzymes. So there are actually 20 different enzymes. One matches up histidine with its tRNA. There are at least 20. One matches up leucine with its tRNA, etc. Now, this says these have many different names. They're usually called loading enzymes. And there are at least 20 different ones for matching up each amino acid to its respective tRNA. We'll talk more about them next time. But you realize that in addition to this, how many different tRNAs are there? I hear 20. Do I hear another estimate? Why more? Because a few what's code for one?
Codons.
A few codons. So there are actually two natural numbers for how many tRNAs they should be. One is 20. What's the other number? How many codons are there?
64.
There are 64 different triplets or codons. So you might argue that there are 64 approximately tRNAs, or you might argue that there are 20. Now, as we will see next time, it's in between. There are about 30. And the reason for that we will explain next time. But you have to have enough to recognize every different codon and correctly and to carry in every amino acid. And it doesn't take 64, as it turns out, but we'll see why next time. So in order to carry out protein synthesis properly, you have to have a complete set of loading enzymes, and you have to have a complete set of transfer RNAs. And we're going to assume for today that the tRNA has gotten its amino acid. How it did that, we will return to next time. All right. Now, what are the structures of the tRNAs? Now, notice there are at least 20 different ones, but all of them have certain features in common. All transfer RNAs are short molecules of RNA. They're all about 75 nucleotides long, and they're all folded back on each other to form regions that are double-stranded and regions that are single. And the structure they take on looks something like this. This is usually called the cloverleaf structure. This is a single chain of nucleotides, but it's folded back on itself. Now, what this implies is that this region is double-stranded because the part on, as it happens, the 3' end has a sequence complementary to what's on the 5' end when you put them anti-parallel. Now, that, but remember, there are 20 at least different ones. So, if let's say you have a lot of A's over here, you have a lot of U's over here. On the other hand, a different one could have a lot of G's on one side, C's on the other. So the sequence is different from tRNA to tRNA, but you always have this stem section where the sequence of one strand is complementary to the other. Now, if you look at this picture, you can see that there are several different regions that are double-stranded because it's folded back on itself. There's this stem on the top, these two sections that lead to loops on the right and left, and this section on the bottom. But there are also loop regions where the RNA is single-stranded and bulging out. One of these is the one at the bottom. This is where the anticodon is. The three bases that are in this part, so-called anticodon loop, these three are complementary to the messenger RNA. Now, our picture on the board is greatly simplified, doesn't show the whole cloverleaf, but it just shows you the end where the amino acid is, which turns out to be the 3' end, which is called the acceptor end. And it shows the anticodon end, which are the two business ends of this molecule. Now, what I have shown you here could be thought of as thought of secondary structure. You had the primary structure, and then you folded it back on itself. But it turns out it's folded even more. It has to be. Let's think why. The way tRNAs work is you line one tRNA on top of AUG, and it carries methionine. You line up one tRNA on top of CAU, and that carries histidine. So you have to get the methionine and the histidine next to each other so you can join them. Well, if tRNA looks like this, it has enormous elbows, these two loops. This is about one codon wide, the anticodon loop. So you couldn't put two of these next to each other on top of a message. They bump into each other. So this thing is folded again on itself. There's a kind of, you might call it in tertiary structure, in 3D, and it looks more like this. This is often called the L form of the tRNA. And here again, you have the anticodon loop at one end, and you have the acceptor end where the amino acid goes on the other end. Now you can see it's folded up, so it's really quite narrow in three dimensions. It's only about three bases wide. And so you could put two of these next to each other on the messenger RNA, no problem, and their two amino acids would be right next to each other, and then you could make the peptide bond. So how do you actually do this? How do you line up the tRNA with the message? Well, I'm going to simplify the tRNA and the message. It's pretty clear that the codon in the message is going to be paired with the anticodon in the tRNA. However, if these two RNAs are paired, are they going to be parallel or anti-parallel? They're always anti. So the message is always written 5 prime to 3 prime, which means that the tRNA, if we're going to write it as a cloverleaf, if we're going to pair up its anticodon with the codon, which way are we going to write the tRNA? Which of the top ends here is the 5 prime? The left or the right? It's going to have to be the right. Normally we would write the 5 prime on the left, but we have to turn the tRNA around if we're fixing the message, so the two will be anti-parallel. So they're written this way. It's usually written this way. And the tRNA, the amino acid, as we'll see, is on the 3 prime end, which is why in this simple picture it's drawn on the left. So how are we going to write that? Let's suppose we're talking methionine. So the codon is AUG. Now what's the anticodon? Well, the obvious thing is you're going to have a U opposite the A, right? You're going to have an A opposite the U, and you're going to have a C opposite the G. So you could say it's UAC. Now what's wrong with UAC? When you write UAC without anything, it implies that the U is on the 5 prime end and the C is on the 3 prime, but this is reversed. And so you have to write 3 prime on the left, 5 prime on the right to make it clear that it's anti-parallel. The other way is sometimes people write it CAU. But the trouble with that is it's not at all obvious that CAU is the partner to AUG. It doesn't look right. So people don't usually write it that way. But sometimes they say it's the same as. There is one other way to do it. Remember the upside down trick? If you have AUG in the message, you can write the anticodon CAU this way, upside down. And that makes it very clear that they are anti-parallel and matching. Now, whatever is easier for you, you can write it UAC or this way, whatever works for you. So how are the tRNA and the amino acid connected? We said the amino acid is on the 3 prime end. What kind of bond is it? And which end of the tRNA, which end of the amino acid is connected? That turns out to be important. If you consider the tRNA chain, there's a base on the very end of the tRNA, on the 3 prime end, and it has a 2 prime hydroxyl and a 3 prime hydroxyl. Usually, we only write the 3 prime because DNA doesn't have a 2 prime. But now we're sticking to RNA, so it has a 2 prime and a 3 prime hydroxyl. The amino acid is linked to one of these by its carboxyl end. So if this is our amino acid, it has a carboxyl, it has an alpha carbon with an R group and an amino. And for this particular purpose, I've written them uncharged. So what you do is you remove water and you make an ester bond between the hydroxyl, one of the hydroxyls on the end, on the last sugar, on the last nucleotide, and the carboxyl of the amino acid. Now, the reason this is important is it means that the amino acid is tied down on its carboxyl end, and its amino end is flapping around. And that will become important when we consider which way do peptides grow. And that, in fact, is really what I want to think about next. We're going to assume, as I mentioned earlier, that every tRNA here has its amino acid attached. How it got there, we will get to next time. tRNA recycles like NAD or CoA. tRNA picks up an amino acid, goes to the message, gives it away. Goes back, gets loaded up again, comes back again, gives its amino acid away. So we're just going to assume that the loading enzymes are working in the background and we don't have to worry about them. We'll do them tomorrow. I mean, Monday. Week from Tuesday. Okay. So, how do you do this? How do you actually line things up? So that's written out on the other side of your handout on 13B. We have a diagram of how you do it. Now, you can see in your diagram that you have messenger RNA. And wherever the first AUG is, that's codon 1. And we have codon 2, whatever they happen to be. And you line up the two respective tRNAs with their amino acids. Okay. And now you make a peptide bond. Now, to see how this goes, I brought a model. I want to do demo. I hope this is big enough. Okay. So here's our messenger RNA. Just a list of codons. Here are our transfer RNAs. Now, this end here is the anticodon, but we have to have an amino acid on the other end. So we'll load them all up. We assume the loading enzymes are doing this job. So we're going to start with all of our tRNA loaded up. Okay. So here's the first AUG in the message. The tRNA that has the anticodon to AUG on the bottom and the right amino acid sits on top. Then the next one here is UUU. So you need a tRNA that has AAA on the bottom, and that happens to be carryphenylalanine. So you put those two here. And now you make a peptide bond. Now, which way you're going to do it is not so obvious, so I'm just going to do this one. It doesn't get interesting till the next one. Now, the first tRNA has now lost its amino acid. It can go get filled up again, come around, and be reused. But now we have our third codon. So here it says UCU, so you'd need the tRNA that has the anticodon properly and the right amino acid. Now at this point, which on your handout is actually when you've gotten to step 3, we made the peptide bond here, and as a result, what we did was to knock the first tRNA, the first amino acid off its tRNA. So we had a tRNA with a short peptide and an empty tRNA. And the empty tRNA, okay, so I'm going to draw that stage. That's 2, that's picture 2. And now I'm going to draw picture 3. So in picture 3 now, The sex tRNA comes in, and we're actually going to need picture four, so I'll draw them all. In picture four, our third tRNA comes in. Now, the important part about this picture, which is number four, it's number three. At this point, we have one tRNA, step four, that has a peptide on it, and one tRNA that has an amino acid. The first time, each tRNA had an amino acid, so there was no obvious distinction. But this time, one tRNA has a peptide, and one tRNA has an amino acid. So we have a choice. We can put the amino acid on the peptide, or the peptide on the amino acid. Now, which seems simpler? Put the amino acid on the peptide, right? Well, if you did that, okay, this tRNA would be finished. Next tRNA would go here. You realize that the tRNA with the peptide would stay put. But the new tRNA with the amino acid would get further and further and further away. Until eventually, I don't know how the enzyme would pull it off. So it doesn't work that way. It works the other way. So let's go back to the beginning. Even though it seems a little silly at first, what you actually do is put the peptide onto the amino acid. Then you can dump your used tRNA. And now a new tRNA holding the next amino acid is in the next codon, right next to the tRNA with a chain. And now you can repeat, you move the chain onto the amino acid. Yes?
How does the tRNA know when to release its...
How does the tRNA know what to do? There are enzymes involved here. When the two... Let's draw the steps more carefully, and I think it will be clearer how you know what to do when. Okay? So that if we go back to our handout again, you see that when you have... Her answer is, how do you know what to do when? One of the answers to this is you have a thing called a ribosome, which is holding all of this together. And a ribosome can hold only two loaded tRNAs. And as a result of that, once you've got, you can't fit more on at a time. And that, in fact, is what makes this an orderly process, as we will explain. But the part that we have so far is just that once you make the peptide bond, then tRNA number one has done its job, and it's eventually going to go off. Now we're going to line up another one. Remember, we can only do two at a time. So the two get together. Now, as soon as they're close enough, the catalyst, which turns out to be part of the ribosome, which is responsible for catalyzing the formation of the peptide bond, causes the peptide to break its linkage to its tRNA and get linked to the next amino acid. Now, how are we going to do this? Amino end, carboxyl end, peptide. Let's go back and look at our picture. Probably it's easiest at this stage right here. We're at stage four. Maybe we can even do it with stage one. What kind of connection is there between the amino acid and the peptide and the tRNA? Which end of the tRNA is connected? The carboxyl end of the amino acid is connected to the 3' end of the tRNA. So from the amino acid version, if we can think about the amino acid, it's the carboxyl end that's tied down. So if we're going to break a connection, if we're going to take amino acid number one off its tRNA, which end are we going to connect to the next amino acid? You could say it the other way. Look at amino acid number two. What's loose? Its amino end is loose. So we're going to have to make a bond between the carboxyl of one and the amino of two. And if we look at stage four, you can see it's sort of the same deal. The peptide's connected by its carboxyl, and the next amino acid has a free amino. And on the pop beads model, it's actually labeled. So what we're going to have to do is break the connection of the peptide to its tRNA and then link its carboxyl to the next amino. So this means when you make a peptide chain, what's loose at the very beginning? Is that the amino or the carboxyl? That has to be the amino. And the last to be made is the carboxyl. It turns out, probably by dumb luck, that we have decided to write both nucleotides and peptides in the order in which they are made. I think the decision to put the amino on the left and the carboxyl on the right was made before anybody knew how they were made. And the same is probably true for nucleotides. But it so happens that the way we conventionally write it and read it is the way in which it is made. Which means that when we get all done, what we're going to have to do is release the very last amino acid from its respective tRNA, and then the protein will be released. Now, as you can see from my model, or from looking at the picture or thinking about this, this is a very shaky affair here. It isn't really held together by much of anything. What really is holding all... You need something to hold all of this together. Because if we go back to the beginning and try again, or if we look at our picture, what is connecting one transfer RNA to the messenger RNA?
Hydrogen.
Hydrogen bonds. What's the maximum number? Three per base pair, right? GC? Okay, there's either two or three base pairs here because it's one base pair. So the maximum is nine. Nine base pairs is not very strong. So you need something else to hold all of this together, and that's the job of the ribosome. So I have here a ribosome. For those of you who have looked at pictures, you realize this does not resemble a ribosome in the slightest. But it has the features of a ribosome. First of all, it has a groove. It has a groove for the message to go through. Second of all, it has two spots for holding loaded tRNA. Only two. Now, a ribosome doesn't really look like this, of course. Ribosomes come in two parts, which are stuck together to carry out protein synthesis. If we have time today, we'll go over the structure. If not, we'll do it next time. If this model were more accurate, this ribosome would come in two parts. It is not true that you have a ribosome that looks like my model, and then you have to take the tRNA and get it to go through the hole. That's not how it works. The way it really works is the ribosome is in two parts, so that if I had done this right, there would be Velcro along here holding the two halves together. There would be a top half and a bottom half. And the two halves of the ribosome come up to the message and clamp on, forming a whole ribosome. So that once the two halves have clamped on, then it looks sort of like this. Ribosome with tRNA, with messenger RNA in the groove. And then they slide relative to each other until the first AUG is in the first position of the ribosome. Now, the ribosome, as we said, has two holes or sites to hold loaded tRNA. So what can happen is the first tRNA with the right anticodon sits on top of the first codon, and the next tRNA with the right anticodon sits on top of the second one. And then the catalyst, which is part of the ribosome, transfers, causes the formation of the peptide bond. But now, the ribosome moves relative to the transfer RNA and the message. In all of the pictures that you see, and in most books, they talk about the ribosome traveling down the message. It is more likely that the message slides through the ribosome and the ribosome stays put. But the net effect is the same, that the ribosome moves toward the 3' end of the message, and the message protrudes further out of the ribosome. Now, there are only two spots on the ribosome for holding loaded tRNA, but there's a third spot on the ribosome for holding empty tRNA. My model doesn't have that. So what would happen is, the empty tRNA would be bumped into that extra site. And then the ribosome would move relative to the message, or the message relative to the ribosome. And the tRNA and the message go together. So we've now moved the tRNA with the peptide over one. And now we have an empty spot for a new aminoacyl tRNA, tRNA carrying amino acid. So let's do it one more time. So now again, you catalyze the formation of the peptide bond, you put the peptide on top of the amino acid. Now, by now, the empty tRNA will have floated away. And now we can bump the new empty tRNA, move it into the appropriate site, and move everybody over one. And you just keep doing that. Now, remember we said there's something called a stop codon? There are no tRNAs that match a stop codon. So if I finally got to a stop codon here, I would have to quit. I couldn't keep going. And that would signal that it's time to release the peptide and start again. We'll talk a little bit more about the start-stop bit this next time, because it turns out that in all macromolecular syntheses, starting is very complicated, stopping is pretty bad, but elongation is easy. Once you get going, you just do the same thing over and over and over again. So we'll come back to the starts and stops. The starts and stops, we're not finished yet. The starts and stops for transcription are different from those for translation and different from those for replication. But the pieces that I want to do now is I want to put the ribosome onto your picture, because I think that makes it much clearer what's going on here. I deliberately drew this picture without a ribosome. But we just said that a ribosome has two sites for loaded tRNA, and it has one site for the empty tRNA. So you can draw it. That's probably the best way. Now, what happens after you make the peptide bond is that nothing's moved yet. But now we're all ready to move, now that we've made the peptide bond, we're ready to move the ribosome relative to the message, or the message relative to the ribosome. So either you think of the ribosome moving down to the right, or the message being pulled to the left one. And the net result is that the empty tRNA now is bumped into the empty site. The tRNA with the peptide has moved over one, and there's now room for the next tRNA. Now, one of the reasons this works is that the three spots or holes on the ribosome or sites are different. They are known respectively as E, P, and A, or A backwards. Now, the A site holds well only a tRNA with an amino acid, therefore the A, also known as an aminoacyl tRNA. The P site only holds well a tRNA with a peptide, or a peptidyl tRNA. And the E site only holds well an empty tRNA. So, as soon as you make the first peptide bond, you've got everything wrong. The A site is supposed to have a tRNA with an amino acid. Oops, it has a tRNA with a peptide. The P site is supposed to have a tRNA with a peptide. It has an empty tRNA. And the empty site has nothing. So this is the signal for everything to move over one. As soon as it does that, now the empty tRNA is in the E site. Excellent. The tRNA with a peptide is in the P site. Excellent. And the tRNA... the A site is now empty, ready for the next tRNA with an amino acid. So the tRNA with an amino acid comes in again. Here's the so this would be, if we drew our ribosome, what would it look like? It's thought that when the new tRNA with an amino acid comes in, that kicks off the empty tRNA. And so now we're ready to do it again. As soon as we make a peptide bond, we're going to have a tRNA with a peptide in the A site, an empty tRNA in the P site, and nothing in the empty site. So we're going to move everybody over again. And that just continues till you get to the end. Now, we have talked about how ribosomes work and what their major features are. And there's only two other things I want to mention here, and then we'll fill in the rest of it next time. First of all, we didn't talk about the properties, the structure, really, of ribosomes. Some of that's outlined underneath your code table, so bring that back when you finally get to class again, which is a long time from now. Bring that handout back, and we'll talk about it. The other thing that's important to realize here, there's some other things in the notes, but we'll go over them next time, is the energy issue. We have basically focused today on the order issue when making proteins. How do you get the amino acids lined up in the right way? We have not talked at all about how you get the energy to do this. This turns out to be an extremely expensive process. You have to use ATP to get the amino acids on the tRNA. And then it's the breaking of this connection that provides the energy to make the peptide bond. You need additional energy, actually in the form of GTP, not ATP, but it's equivalent, to move the ribosome relative to the message, and also probably to bind some of these things together. So it's quite expensive. To add one amino acid takes several ATPs. And that is one of the reasons that protein synthesis is thought to be so tightly regulated. Because if you make proteins you don't need, you waste buckets of ATP. So when we finish protein synthesis, one of the next topics we'll talk about is how you regulate protein synthesis so that you don't waste ATP. So we're going to stop here. This lecture is not on the exam. There's no class next Tuesday, but next Tuesday afternoon there's a Q&A section. There are lots of office hours next week. That's all on the website. Thursday morning next week, there is a review session, question and answer. Thursday night, there is an exam, and the following Tuesday is the next lecture. If there are any questions about any of that, don't hesitate to ask me. That's the afternoon? No. The Tuesday review is at the time and place of the usual Tuesday after evening class.
Evening class.
The Thursday morning review is this time, this place.
Only handout for month 12.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, this one.